Hi, everybody. My name is Charles. I'm one of the pastors on the teaching team. Welcome to Love This Book online. Now, this video is matching Easter Sunday, and we're having normal Easter Sunday service at Blocklock. So Pastor Matt is preaching. So for those of you doing Love This Book, this video is for. Now, the format is, this is not a sermon. I'm not going to be up here talking on. It's going to be like pretty short, 10, 15 minutes. You can watch it in your life group if you like. And what's going on is I'm assuming that you read the texts, and I'm going to be making some comments about them. We're going to break this video into about, five different clips, and each clip will address one of the interesting passages. And the one we're going to start with on this first clip is this David and the Bathsheba story. We're looking at the downfall of the kings, and the downfall of the Davidic kings begins with David and Bathsheba. And I want to make a couple of comments about the text because they're kind of fun. If you look at chapter 11, verse 1, it says, "In the spring, at the times when kings go off to war, David sent Joab," wait a minute, where's David, right? "out with the king's men and the whole Israelite army. They destroyed the Ammonites and besieged Rabbah, but David remained in Jerusalem." So the story begins already, something is off. Where is David? Why come he's sending somebody else to do the job? Now, the fun thing about the way biblical authors do, they're so subtle in the way they tell stories. And here in verse 2, "One evening, David got up from his bed and walked around." Just going to pause right there. When did David get up? He got up evening. Okay, something's off with David. He got out of bed in the evening time, and he's walking around the palace. Sees a beautiful woman. Brings her to his palace, and then there's this wonderful little verse 4, a little sideline that the narrator throws in. "Then David sent messengers to get her. She came to him, and he slept with her." In quotation, now she was purifying herself from her monthly uncleanness. Why do you think the author put that in there? What's that doing there? Well, you find out in verse 5, the woman conceived and was sent word to David saying, "I am pregnant." Right? So these are the way the author's kind of like making sure you know, oh, it really is David's baby, right? Because she just had her period. So these are the kind of ways the author's giving you details about the story. Now, I'm going to recount a little bit about what happened with her husband Uriah, because I think it's important to recognize what David's plan was. Some people read the text and go, wait, what's going on here? David brings Uriah back with one plan. Uriah's his soldier, and he brings him back with one plan in mind. Get him home so he can make love to his wife. Why? Because there's no DNA testing back then, no paternity suits. So that's what it's all about. And so he really tries to get him to go home, gets him drunk. It just doesn't work. So he's trying to cover up this whole marriage and this pregnancy thing is not working. And he finally has to go with murder. So he sends Joab the note. And Joab, of course, realized the plan doesn't work. He can't just kill one guy. He ends up killing multiple people. So we start with this problem with David. He's having some kind of issue, some kind of crisis. It leads to a moment of lust and a moment of indiscretion. It becomes, it snowballs into not just murdering one person, but murdering multiple people. And now this is where David ends up. And then he ends up talking to the prophet Nathan, who tells him, God has forgiven your sins, but there's going to be consequences to this. And so you see this amazing passage. He says in verse 11 of chapter 12, this is what Yahweh says, out of your own household, I'm going to bring calamity on you. Before your very eyes, I will take your wives and give them to one who is close to you, and he will sleep with your wives in broad daylight. You did it in secret, but I will do this thing in broad daylight before all Israel. That prediction from Nathan, it connects this story of David and Bathsheba to what happens next. And we're going to talk about it in the next clip. But one of the big ideas from here is you can be forgiven, but the consequences of sin lives on. So this is some thoughts on the story of Amnon, Tamar, and Absalom. This, we're moving on to David's children. Now, what's striking about this story, I mean, if you read this book, you know what's going on. Amnon rapes his half-sister, Tamar. Tamar's full brother, Absalom, gets revenge by murdering Amnon, and the whole thing spins out of control. Absalom gets sent into exile, and for 2 years, and when he comes back, he initiates a revolution against David and try to overthrow him. And he does overthrow him successfully until his army was routed by David's men and Absalom was killed. Right? Now, this is all happening within David's family. What's going on here? Well, a couple things. One is, of course, this is connected to David and Bathsheba. The prophet Nathan made it very clear that these stories are connected. But one of the things to note is that the connection isn't just kind of miraculous, magical. There's real human elements of the connection. First thing you notice is that the sins of the father tend to repeat itself in the sins of the sons. What is Amnon's problem? He's struck by lust for his half-sister, somebody he shouldn't be, or at least without, not without permission, but the same way with David, with his lust for Absalom, Amnon's lust for his sister. And second, this lust and the successional course leads to murder, right? Leads to murder. Now, here's what's going on that's interesting, is that once David finds out that what Amnon did, he was very upset about the rape, but he does nothing. That's the thing that's going to strike you. That starting in chapter 13, David becomes a very passive agent. One of the characterizations of David is that he starts responding to events and basically doing what people tell him. Again and again, you'll see the much stronger characters are running the show. And this is very different from the David we met in 1 Samuel and the beginning of 2 Samuel. And that's just not, David's a warrior. David's a take-charge guy. But after Bathsheba, he loses any kind of moral standing to do justice, to judge anything. So Amnon rapes his daughter. His son rapes his daughter. He does nothing. What can he do? I mean, he knows he did the same thing with Absalom. He committed murder. He has no moral standing, and he loses that ability. Same thing with Absalom. Absalom kills Amnon. Once again, he does nothing. He runs away for 2 years. He wants to bring him back, couldn't do it. It all requires other people to make it all happen. And the lack of reconciliation allows Absalom to go ahead and take the stock of the situation and decided to overthrow his own father. And even at the end, when Absalom is dead, David's like crying for his son. And Joab says, slaps him around basically and says, you got to snap out of this because you're going to lose your whole army if you keep this up. Right. And once again, when he returns to Jerusalem, there's a problem there and it causes a division. And then there's kind of a split between Judah and the northern tribes. All of this because David loses agency. And this is one of the key lessons from this passage is when there's moral failure, leaders can no longer lead. They lose the ability to take action. Now, we're looking at the story of transition between David and Solomon. And there's this fascinating passage that I thought I want to share with you guys. As you're reading through, you might have just kind of overlooked it, but it's a fun passage. There's kind of a little bit of an intrigue about who's going to replace David. Solomon wins the prize, and he's going to be the king. And now in chapter 2 of 1 Kings, David gives Solomon his charge. And it's an interesting study about the tension between kingship and being faithful to God. Okay. Verse 2, chapter 2, verse 1. When the time drew near for David to die, he gave a charge to Solomon his son. I'm about to go the way of all the earth, he said. So be strong, act like a man, and observe what Yahweh your God requires. Okay, that's good. Walk in obedience to him and keep his decrees and commands, his laws and regulations as written in the law of Moses. Do this so that you may prosper in all you do and wherever you go. And Yahweh may keep his promise to me. If your descendants watch how they live, and if they walk faithfully before me with all their heart and soul, you will never fail to have a successor on the throne of Israel. So that's verses 1-4. Basically, David says, look, be the ideal king. Follow the laws of God, be obedient to Yahweh, and God made this promise, the Davidic covenant that Pastor Daniel talked about, right? Somebody's going to be on the throne from my line, the dynasty of David, if the kings follow the laws. Okay? And that's all very good. It's all very faithful. It's awesome. And then we switch to verse 5. The verse 4, verse 5, the transition is so jarring, right? You end with, oh, if you walk faithfully before me with all their heart and soul, you will never fail to have a successor on the throne of Israel. Now you yourself know what Joab, son of Zeruiah, did to me and what he did to the two commanders of Israel's armies, Abner, son of Ner, and Amasa, son of Jether. He killed them. shedding their blood in peacetime as if in battle. And with that blood, he stained the belt around his waist and the sandals on his feet. Do you deal with him according to your wisdom, but do not let his gray head go down to the grave in peace. Okay. Show kindness to son of Barzillai of Gilead. That's verse 7. And verse 8, you have with you, remember, you have with you Shimei, son of Gera. Kill him as well. I mean, that's pretty much what happens next. So it's really interesting. You have this obey God, observe God, follow God, and then take out this guy, be nice to this guy, take out this guy. It's a juxtaposition of idealism, following Yahweh, and then real politic. These people need to be dealt with. And there's kind of these ruthless exercise of state power. Okay, people need to be wiped out. I couldn't do it. Wipe it out for me. You're my son. Take care of business after I'm dead. And that's just kind of one of the built-in contradiction of dealing with power and following God and faithfulness. And it's right here in these kind of passages. And how do you actually deal with that tension as a king, right? And the kind of kingdom that it requires to be able to resolve this between earthly power and kind of a divine calling. It's a great question, that something we really won't see resolved until we get to the New Testament and we get to a king who leads a different kind of a kingdom. We're now looking at the Solomon's reign. That's chapters 1 through 11 in 1 Kings. And before I get into it, I wanted to talk a little bit about how Hebrew authors write stories. We're so used to having books and papers, and we read things, and we think, oh, okay, yeah, they must have done it in the ancient world. Well, that's not the case. The ancient world is heavily focused on an oral culture. That is, everything is really spoken and heard, even what's written down. Few people can read it out loud, and they read it out loud to everybody else because nobody else has the scrolls. And what that means is that that oral culture really impacts how stories are told. They tend to be highly structured. That is to say, there's kind of a common structure to stories. And one of the most popular structures in the Old Testament storytelling is the story structure called chiasm, or chiastic structure. The word chiasm comes from the Greek alphabet chi, which in its capital form, just an X. Okay, it's just an X. So a chiastic structure is something that resembles an X in that it kind of comes down to a pivot and then slides down this way. So it forms kind of this semi-triangular shape in which the elements, the beginning element matches the final element. And the second element matches the second to the final element, so on and so forth until you get to the middle part, and that's what is known as the pivot. The pivot of a chiastic structure is the theological focus of that story. The pivot is the most important element. Now, why am I talking about this? Because this chiastic structure is all over the Old Testament. It shows up in a few verses, shows up in a couple of chapters, and also shows up in large scale. And scholars have noticed that chapters 1 through 11 of 1 Kings is one massive chiastic structure. Now, you should be seeing this on the screen. The entire 11 chapters in a large chiastic structure. It begins with a prophet intervenes in royal succession, and the structure ends with a prophet determines the royal succession. Solomon eliminates threats to his security, parallels with Yahweh raises up threats to Solomon's security. Early promise of Solomon's reign parallels with tragic failure of Solomon's reign. Solomon's use of wisdom for people, Solomon uses wisdom for himself. Preparations for building the temple, and Solomon dedicates the temple and is warned by God. And Solomon begins building the temple, Solomon completes building the temple, and then finally there is the middle, the pivot, the 12 verses, chapter 7, verses 1 through 12, Solomon builds rival buildings. If you don't think chiastically, those 12 verses are really weird. Because you're reading along, you go, okay, we're reading about the temple, and it's a really long section, 12 verses that are not about the temple, and then boom, we're back to the temple. That makes no sense. Until you see the chiastic structure and you realize the narrator intentionally stuck a section right in the middle of the storytelling. And I'll just read the first couple verses. It took Solomon 13 years, however, to complete the construction of his palace. That's a however. Let's read the last verse of the previous chapter. In the 11th year, in the month of Bul, the 8th month, the temple was finished in all its details according to specifications. He has spent 7 years building it. And then we give verse 1. How many years? 13 years. Solomon spent 7 years on the temple, 13 years on his own palace. And we stuck that right in the middle of this large chiastic structure. What it's getting at is Solomon is about himself more so than God, right? Remember the Davidic covenant passage that Pastor Daniel talked about, where David is in his own palace and he says, God's living in a tent. Huh, I want to build him a house. Right? It's like, I have something, I want to build him a house. And here Solomon says, well, God's building a temple, I need to build a bigger one. And that's what's going on. And so this entire storyline pivots at this moment, and we see that Solomon is not a person fully after God. And toward the end, he actually leads people into idolatry. And as an end result, after Solomon dies, his son, Jeroboam, loses half the kingdom. The kingdom of Israel splits into two. There's a northern kingdom called Israel, and there's a southern kingdom called Judah. And the Davidic kings, the Davidic dynasty, continues in Judah, but the north goes a separate way. And that was a punishment for Solomon's failure to keep covenant, because he elevated himself above God. So what do we learn from this passage, the fall of kingship, the beginning of the fall of kingship? We have David with Bathsheba. We have the civil war, the family strife. Then we have Solomon, such early promise, and then falling away. And what we have is this. And the number one thing to note is these are kings in the line of David. David's king after God's own heart. Okay, this is not Saul. This is not the warrior king. This is the king that God chose. And it still doesn't work. There's something just deeply flawed about humanity, that no matter how much they are trained up to love God and read scripture, they rebel. And so David is sucked in by first of all, kind of he's a little off. He's not feeling very well, but by a moment of lust and a loss of self-control that spins the entire nation into turmoil. Solomon, similarly, pride and ego, and then eventually being pulled, like his father, by his wives into worshiping other gods. And so the kings of the Davidic dynasty are pulled away. They are tempted. So even then, they're not able to pull this off. Now, a couple of things to learn from this. One, of course, is that temptation strikes everyone, and it's very basic. And sin has consequences. And we talked about that what David did in one moment reverberated throughout the entire nation. And we also talked about how he, once you lose your moral standing, you really have a hard time leading. And David has a hard time leading and being that kind of a person who can provide the moral framework for the nation. He fails that for, not just for the nation, for his own family. But one of the things I want to highlight, and that's interesting, is that if you look at David, he commits adultery and murder, and yet he is still the king after God's own heart. So just kind of notice that in the Old Testament, the bar is set pretty low when it comes to ethical behavior. Okay, I say that kind of as kind of a joke. But what I mean by that really is this, is that God wants people to live out his character, obviously. But what he wants first and foremost are people who are passionate for his kingdom. David, doesn't matter all his faults, he is a man. He's God's man through and through. He is on the side of God. He's like, I'm there. I'm fully allied with God, and I'm going to screw up. I'm sorry about that, but I am still on your side. And that's why God forgives him, and he is still the king, even after the mess he created. Solomon's a different story. Solomon is gifted with a great father, with wisdom early on, and yet his ego and his being drawn to other gods means that he breaks covenant. He never murders anyone. He, in many ways, is way better ethically than his father. And yet, the judgment on him is much stronger. The judgment on him is that God is going to split his kingdom and take a big chunk away from the Davidic dynasty. And he keeps the Davidic dynasty going for the sake of David. Okay, he punishes Solomon severely. In the storyline, Solomon's the bad guy. Even though you think, wait, what's going on here? And the reason is because God's using different evaluative framework. He's evaluating based on, are you with me or not? And if you are, I'm going to overlook some stuff. And for God, finding people who are passionate about him, that seems to be challenging for him. And so he is passionate about those who are passionate about him. All right. Well, thank you for watching. And this has kind of been some observations and thoughts about the passage we're looking at. And we look forward to continuing. We love this book later on. Thank you.